Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Legislative Monday with my co-host, Katarina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter, with us from the State House Law Library in Des Moines. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
This hour, we are going to tackle a couple of issues being debated at the State House. Later in the hour, we'll discuss a proposal that would expand access to birth control here in Iowa. Under that plan, contraceptives would be available directly through pharmacies. We'll talk about that later in the hour with lawmakers, also the executive vice president and CEO of the Iowa Pharmacy Association. But first of all, last week, a bill that would remove the time limit on filing criminal charges in child sex abuse cases advanced in the Iowa Senate. There's also a proposal to remove the time limit in filing civil lawsuits related to child sex abuse cases. So in this first half hour, we want to get a sense of the future of these proposals. In a minute, we'll hear from lawmakers and from a survivor of sex abuse as a child. But first, Katarina, give us a little more background on this issue and tell us what's happening at the State House on it.
A Senate subcommittee did advance a bill last week to remove the criminal statute of limitations in child sex abuse cases. Under current Iowa law, you have to charge a perpetrator with a crime within 10 years of the victim's 18th birthday and within 3 years of the perpetrator being identified by DNA. So this actually passed the Iowa Senate last year, but it didn't pass the House. There were reportedly some concerns because it wasn't that long ago that the statute of limitations was extended to its current position. And there seems to be support in the Senate to pass this again. The chair of the House Judiciary Committee has expressed interest in at least extending, if not removing, the statute of limitations. And then Senator Peterson has also filed a bill to remove the civil statute of limitations. The current law is very complicated with that. An extension of the civil statute passed the Senate last year, but didn't pass the House. This year, it hasn't had a first hearing yet. And this is also sort of part of a national trend of states moving in this direction to relax these statutes of limitations. But there's a lot of different ways that states are doing this.
What about this proposal involving civil litigation? And I know Senator Peterson is with you, but give us an overview quickly on that.
Well, if this is passed, it would give a bigger time period for people to sue either individuals or organizations over abuse that they experience as a child.
Okay, we want to have you join us if you would have a question or perhaps an experience that has to do with child sex abuse. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Joining us this first half hour, Senator Dan Dawson from Senate District 8 in Council Bluffs. Senator Dawson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here today.
And I understand you've got just a few minutes before you have a commitment. You have to be off, so we'll make use of your time and then turn the microphone over to Senator Peterson. Tell us about your view on this change of eliminating statute of limitations.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that Senator Peterson and I had some good conversations last year about, and we did pass a bill out of the Senate. I believe it was 50-0 or 49-0. You know, me being having a law enforcement background and just seeing different situations out there, there's a lot of study and a lot of information regarding this. And a lot of times, child sexual assault victims don't come forward within that 10-year statute of limitation. Actually, a majority of them come forward between 15 and 20 years in a large body of the instances, and sometimes much longer than that, primarily because a lot of the child sexual assault victims, the perpetrators are someone they're related to. And those family ties don't go away that soon, you know, or it could be clergy as well. People who have a long attachment to that individual through second and third relations. So there's a reason why that these victims have a delayed report, more than just 10 years and everything. Last year we did pass a bill out of the Senate. Was not taken up in the House. So this year we actually have two different bills. We have one that was passed out of the Senate subcommittee last week, which is a total removal from 18 and below. And then we have another bill later on here today, which is part of a larger omnibus bill. and that raises it from 10 years to 15 years. We've had some really positive conversations with Chairman Holt, as well as Chairman Klein over in the House, both who personally expressed that we'd like to see removal entirely of the statute of limitations. But as many things here in the State House, legislation becomes a process of not perfect, but what's possible. So we're going to start off with two different bills here, one moving up 5 years and one removing entirely, and hopefully we can get enough support on both sides of this issue to bring a little more abilities for law enforcement and hopefully bring some justice for victims.
Senator, so this criminal statute of limitations bill has moved forward in the Senate. The one for the civil statute of limitations, Senator Amy Sinclair would be the one to schedule a subcommittee for that. She says she hasn't done it yet. She's not sure if she will, basically, and that she would like to look at the criminal piece before moving on to the civil piece. What do you think of that approach?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of lands us back to why where we're at here this year. I think a lot of times from a legislative standpoint, there's advantages to starting off strong, and once in a while there's advantages or disadvantages starting off strong, which is why something I want to get done this year. So we're going to have two different options, a starting off small, starting off strong, and hopefully get something done. But when it comes to, the bill that Senator Sinclair has, that becomes hard trying to reduce back, an indefinite or the mechanics of that bill here. So and this is a complicated issue. We have a, for better or for worse, and I think it's probably for the better, we do have a lot of attorneys here in the legislative body, in the House and the Senate, and a lot of different perspectives on this. There are conversations I've had with House members trying to figure out a way forward this year. It is not a partisan issue. There is bipartisan support and there is some bipartisan concerns. So again, becomes the art of the possible of what can we do to try to advance something forward and bring some justice.
Senator Dawson, when you talk about the bipartisan concerns about this change, what are the nature of those concerns and how do you counter them or answer them?
Well, like we would do anything else, we'd like to just listen to what their concerns are. And actually, is it a belief or is it based in fact? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we try to sift through right now. I don't want to speak for those individual members there because we are trying to have some positive conversations. I think there's a lot of persons who have some experience on the civil side of law. I mean, that's not my personal experience, but persons who have practiced there or whatnot. Have some concerns or have raised some expressions about maybe a different way or to address this issue here. And like I said, I'm trying to have positive conversations and listening right now. And again, I'm trying to figure out if it's a personal belief or if it's data-based, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Senator Dawson, thank you so much for your time. You do have a commitment, but thank you for stepping into the State House Law Library for this short conversation.
Thank you. Take care.
Also with us, Senator Janet Peterson at the State House Law Library. Senator Peterson, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You are a Democrat in District 18 in Des Moines. You've been working on this issue for years. Why do you think we need this change?
Well, I have been working on this issue for years because I think we need to do a better job in our state of protecting our children. Our current laws protect predators and organizations that cover up crimes against our children, and I don't believe we should have a statute of limitation in place, either civil or criminal, for those who prey on our children. It allows them to continue preying on other innocent victims.
Explain that, because all might not understand when you say protect predators, our current laws. How do our laws currently protect predators? Give us an example.
Well, we could talk, for instance, of people who, survivors of child sexual abuse that are unable to come to terms and articulate what transpired. By the time many of them are able to come forward, the clock has already run out on their ability to seek justice. So the clock benefits the perpetrator. It also benefits the organization that may have covered up the crime.
Senator Peterson, we want to invite also here a survivor of childhood clergy sex abuse in the Sioux City area. Bob Baxter joins us by phone. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I understand you are 65 years old now.
I hate to admit that.
Not a bad age.
I guess not.
Take us back to the times, the circumstances of your abuse. What year would we be talking about?
Well, it was back in the late 60s. I actually, maybe the word is suppressed all of the memory of this until I actually was abused by two priests, and I recalled the most, probably the worst experiences that I was having, I just recalled here about a year ago or so.
I just want to mention, Bob, last week, it's pertinent here, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Sioux City made public a list of 28 priests credibly accused of sexually abusing minors. Your abusers were on that list?
Yes, both of them.
Both of them.
And they both have died. And one of the abusers also abused my sister. And she had, all she wanted was an apology from the priest and diocese, that's all. And she filed papers, filed suit against the diocese, and a statute of limitations issue came up, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Peterson said this current law is protecting sexual predators. Is that the way you see it in your case, for instance? I mean, the abusers are no longer living in this case, but you have strong views on this.
Right. One of the priests died, I'm going to say approximately 8 years ago. And the other was longer than that. But they continued with their jobs of being a pastor or a priest, and by going at that rate, a lot of suppression, my understanding is, comes to the surface at 50 years old and older. And if you put some sort of a time limit, even 5 years additional is what I heard. And I know there's two ways to approach it, aggressively or not aggressively. And let's face it, the 5 years really is not going to do anything. And it's not going to stop anyone. These abusers are probably going to abuse no matter if the statute is in existence or not. The problem is that in this case, the Diocese of Sioux City knew, especially one of the priests, had been moved around several times.
Okay.
And he was moved around several times because he had issues with a child.
Okay, Bob, we have limited time, and there's so many facets we could explore with that tragic abuse that you suffered in the late 60s, but perhaps we can turn back to Senator Peterson and now. So this is a case in which, and I'm sure, Janet Peterson, you have studied many cases like this. This sounds familiar. Here we have Bob saying he really suppressed these memories for decades.
That's right. And Bob's case, unfortunately, is not alone. I've had many Iowans come see me at the State House, call me, email me, explaining similar circumstances where they were unable to talk about the abuse. I've had a couple women who confided in me that they had never told anyone in their families. And if we have a statute of limitations in place, it will be harder for them to go after their predator and the organizations that covered up the crime. I had a gentleman from a small town who had a woman who was abused as a child. She saw her predator applying to drive an Iowa school bus, and they were unable to do anything about it because the statute of limitations had already expired, and it's just devastating to see this person who was a predator being allowed to be around other children, and she was not able to seek justice and do what she thought was needed to protect Iowa children. Mm-hmm.
Senator Peterson, can you talk a bit about, so the criminal statute of limitations issue, of course, would affect individual perpetrators. Can you talk about how the civil statute of limitations and removing or changing that might affect organizations in which this abuse might be happening?
Right. Well, right now, our law really does benefit organizations that have covered up sex abuse crimes against our children. If a child is abused by a school employee, a counselor, or a therapist, that child only has 5 years from the time they end treatment or leave that school to go after them civilly. So technically, someone who is abused as a kindergartner would have their statute run out, you know, by the time they're 10 years old. The most that someone would have to go after civilly under current law is until their 19th birthday. Now, the legislature last year passed a bill that gave landlords 20 years to go after delinquent renters for their rent. So it's really hard for me to sit back and watch them continue to ignore this issue that gives victims and survivors of child sexual abuse just 1 year after turning 18 when they've had the political courage to do increased statute of limitations for other areas of the law.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you noted, Senator Peterson, this isn't just relating to clergy sex abuse. This is all child sex abuse crimes. We've got about 5 minutes left. Let's make sure we hear from John in Cedar Rapids, one of our listeners. John, welcome to the program. You have a connection to our issue today.
Yes, I do, sir.
Go ahead, please. What would you like to share?
I am 59 years old, and like the previous person that was on the radio from Sioux City, I had repressed memories. They just came back a little over a year ago. Can't really go into too much detail about my case and stuff like that as much as I'd like to. I can't. However, it has caused me to have post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder. Like I said, I did have a repressed memory. It's really affected my life in many ways, just not with the bipolar disorder, but as well as in relationships that I've been in throughout my life and other ways that it's just way too hard for me to explain.
Would this, John, removal of the statute of limitations serve your purposes? Would it change your life? Would it change the way you pursued this, perhaps legally?
It would really be great if it would change, you know, the civil statute of limitations. Yeah, if it did, it would probably make a whole lot of difference on my case. I don't know a lot, but I've suffered greatly. I was abused over 100 to 150 times between the time I was 11 years old and 15 years old.
Well, John, thank you for coming forward and sharing with us so that we may know the extent of this problem and meet the challenge here. John in Cedar Rapids, thank you so much.
I just hope that I got this word out to everybody, and let's get this going, please.
Okay. Katarina, did you have something to jump in here with?
Yes, Senator Peterson. So we've obviously heard these two very compelling stories from abuse survivors. What are the arguments you hear from lawmakers against changing the statute of limitations or eliminating it?
I still have yet to hear a decent argument against changing the civil statute of limitations. The Catholic Church says that it would be hard for them to defend themselves. But essentially, I believe it all stems down to money. But I don't believe any organization should be allowed to take crime into their own hands. These issues need to go to the courts and law enforcement. When children are abused, they need to be turned over to law enforcement, and we should have laws that put our children first.
Bob Baxter, you're on the phone with us from the Sioux City area, I believe. Does this seem like a no-brainer to you? It sounds like it, by the way, by your personal experience. And can you imagine opposition to this? What would you say to opposition?
No, I can't imagine any rational thought on having a problem with eliminating statute of limitations. Like Senator said, I believe it does come down to money. Now, Catholic Church and diocese is saying that they would have a difficult time defending themselves. Mm-hmm. But in my case, they knowingly passed the guy around. And that is specific from various different parishes. In fact, one parish filed in one parish, he was sued, and the individual won the case. So this is not an issue of maybe defending themselves. They have no basis of defending themselves at all. They just passed them around.
Bob Baxter, before we say goodbye, could you tell us briefly, how did the priests who abused you, you said two and two on this list that the Roman Catholic Diocese of Sioux City made public just last week, how did the priests who abused you rationalize it to you?
Well, the priest that actually started the abuse, I was considering becoming a priest at the time, and I was a very religious family, and the priest had known that I was interested in becoming a priest, and he turned this abuse into, started it as a ritual type of thing that new priests go through, and it can help you make your decision a little easier, and, you know, so it was a ritual type of thing
Wow.
for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Bob Baxter, thank you for joining us here. Janet Peterson, in closing, what do you see the future of this change? Something will happen. Can you predict that?
Well, I think we have better chances this year with this criminal statute of limitations, but I would urge Iowans to contact their lawmakers if they'd like us to make progress on civil statute of limitations. It's going to take their voices to get this through the legislature. And for survivors like Bob, who have been brave enough to come forward, they will not receive help unless the civil statute of limitations comes through. So I'd encourage Iowans to speak up and have their voices heard.
Thank you for coming in, Senator Janet Peterson of Des Moines. Bob Baxter joining us by phone, 65 years old now, survivor of childhood clergy sex abuse in the Sioux City area. Bob, thank you. Wish you well.
Thank you.
Senator Dan Dawson, Republican, joined us earlier. When we come back, Katarina Sestarek and I will switch gears to talk about a proposal to expand access to birth control in Iowa. We'll also talk with two representatives in our legislature about that. We'll also talk with the Executive Vice President and CEO of the Iowa Pharmacy Association. Perhaps you have some thoughts on expanding access to birth control across the state. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
Glad you could join us midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, I'll discuss the newly issued, in fact, it'll be issued tomorrow, the 2019 Cancer in Iowa report. We'll have a variety of specialists talking about it. Also, we'll find out tomorrow about one of the fastest growing types of cancer in our state. It's one that is entirely preventable. Tomorrow on the program, we'll focus on cancer and the new tomorrow to be issued 2019 Cancer in Iowa report. Today, Legislative Monday, my co-host Katarina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter at the Statehouse Law Library. This half hour, Katarina, we want to discuss a proposal that would expand access to birth control in Iowa. Fill us in on this one. What is the move afoot?
Lawmakers in the House and Senate have advanced this proposal that was brought forth by Governor Kim Reynolds. It would allow Iowans to get birth control directly from a pharmacist without first going to a clinic to get a prescription. It's not over the counter. That's a misconception that some people have. Some are calling it behind-the-counter birth control. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who would want to do that would have to go through a little health screening questionnaire with the pharmacist. It would have to be completed before the patient could obtain birth control in this method. And if there are any red flags in that person's health history, or if the person hasn't seen a doctor in a while, then the pharmacist could refer that person to a doctor. And this would apply to birth control pills, contraceptive patches, and vaginal rings. And patients would have to be 18 years old.
Okay, let's welcome our two lawmakers for this half hour. Representative Beth Wessel-Crochelle is with us, a Democrat in District 45 in Ames. Representative Wessel-Crochelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to mention you're a ranking member on the House Human Resources Committee. Representative Shannon Lundgren is with us as well, a Republican from District 57, Piazza in northeast Iowa. Representative Lundgren, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You chair the House Human Resources Committee. So let's talk about this. Let's start off with you, Representative Lundgren. What are you seeing happening here and the support within your party for it?
Well, I think the bill that came from Governor Reynolds, which we're referring to as HSB 214, is a way for us to open dialogue about making sure that birth control is accessible in the state. The best way to prevent pregnancy is obviously the use of birth control and natural family planning methods. But the easier we make it, the more we restrict abortions in the state.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wessel-Crochelle.
Yeah, I think this is a good step in the right direction. I'm a supporter of comprehensive reproductive health care, and this creates an opportunity for healthy adult women to get access to birth control. It certainly isn't a solution to the entire issue.
Mm-hmm. So, Representative Wessel-Crochelle, you see widespread support in your party. Democrats, though in the minority in both houses, are supporting this?
I believe so. It has not been a big topic of conversation. It is kind of a small bill, but I would see no reason that we would not support it.
And Representative Lundgren, how do you feel about your party's support?
Well, we're certainly having discussions on it. We have an amendment that'll come forth just to ensure that women's health care is being taken care of on the preventative side down the road. We don't want this to be a end-all be-all when it comes to women's health care issues, and just ensuring that there are other steps that'll be taken in the future to ensure that they are getting those screenings that they need.
Representative Lundgren, can you describe any opposition to this that you've encountered, or what concerns constituents have about this? What are you anticipating?
Well, I think when we had our subcommittee meeting last week, we heard several concerns. One is, again, that preventative health care for women, ensuring that they are going to get their exams on a regular basis. And then a couple other concerns that were brought up was just the cost of the contraceptives when we issue them for a year, and let's say it doesn't work, and we're not aware of it not working or affecting the woman in different ways. We've already prescribed it for 12 months. That comes at a cost. So we're looking at maybe possibly doing a three-month dispensation at first and then having the woman come back in just to make sure that everything is working okay for her and she doesn't have side effects from it. And a couple other things that were of concern, human trafficking was brought up. You know, is this an opportunity for people to come in and get prescription contraceptives for women that maybe they are being human trafficked? And we think we can kind of handle that through our PMP, our prescription monitoring program in the state of Iowa, which we talked a lot about last year when we talked about opioid legislation. It's just a great tool for pharmacists to be able to look and see whether a woman has been dispensed contraceptives. And then the other thing that we wanted to make sure was that an ID was given when it was being dispensed to make sure that the woman is of 18 and can attest that her health is in good standing and that, she meets kind of all the criteria to dispense.
I wonder, Representative Lundgren, we've had, let me turn to you first of all, Representative Wessel-Crochelle. We've had significant cuts to family planning, women's health services in the state, in other areas. Is there a concern, do you think, that this will prevent funding for other services for those that have already been cut?
I don't know that this will be an additional cut. I'm hoping that this, starts to fill in that hole. We are 50th in the country in the number of OBGYNs per capita, and that's a huge problem. So assuring that women can get in for reproductive health care to an expert becomes a real challenge for many women. The pill, the patch, and the ring are effective forms of birth control, but in the pill, where it has to be taken every day, we find that it's not as effective as some of the other forms of birth control that you will still have to go to a physician to get. For example, the IUD, and there are a couple of others that require a medical procedure in order to use them. So access to comprehensive health care, I think, is really important, to cancer screenings, to STD screenings and treatment. All those things need to be considered when we're talking about women's reproductive health care, and that is not addressed in this bill.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the proposal at the Iowa State House to expand access to birth control in Iowa, legislation to make contraceptives more readily available. These would be directly through a pharmacy, but as my co-host Katarina Sestorek said, it's not to be thought of as over-the-counter. Sort of behind-the-counter is a phrase that they're giving it, originally put forward by Governor Kim Reynolds. Join our conversation with your thoughts about expanding access to birth control. Perhaps you have concerns. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's welcome Kate Gaynor to our conversation. Kate is Executive Vice President and CEO of the Iowa Pharmacy Association. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So pharmacists, pharmacies in all of our 99 counties in the state, so this would really increase access, wouldn't it?
It has the potential to, and pharmacists have the training and the relationships with patients and consumers in their communities to offer this type of service.
What is the position of the Iowa Pharmacy Association?
The Iowa Pharmacy Association is generally supportive of the governor's proposal and really a number of proposals that use pharmacists to a greater extent in the communities across the state to increase access. And for birth control, they're very common prescriptions, so pharmacists already have a lot of knowledge. There are a number of different hormonal contraceptives available today, and pharmacists have a good understanding of those different, not only methods like the pill, the patch, the ring, but even the different doses among the many birth control pills that exist. So pharmacists are very ready to be able to provide this service. And of course, pursuant to the legislation, there may be additional requirements that would have to be undertaken. But I would say generally, without knowing all of the details, the Pharmacy Association and our members are supportive of these types of proposals.
Mm-hmm. The bill does mention possible continuing education mm-hmm. for pharmacists who might want to participate in this. But I've also heard that there's a difference in the training of newer pharmacists and older pharmacists, that newer pharmacists have gone through more years of training to become a pharmacist. Is there any difference between, you know, maybe possibly older and younger pharmacists and how much training they'd have to get to do this?
I think those are the details that would come via rules by the Board of Pharmacy and the Department of Public Health. But yes, since about 2000, the year 2000, all pharmacists graduate with their doctorate of pharmacy degree. So there is an additional 1 to 2 years of that training that pharmacists get to receive their doctorate degree, where pharmacists that would have graduated prior to that time had a bachelor's degree in pharmacy. But all pharmacists, in order to maintain their license, are required every year to receive continuing education. So whether I graduated in the early 2000s or a pharmacist that graduated decades before me, each year new drugs become available, whether that's in a hospital setting or a pharmacist that works in a cancer clinic and new oncology medication. So wherever a pharmacist practices and the types of drugs that they routinely see and help their patients with, they're receiving continuing education to stay up to date. But I look at this somewhat similarly to pharmacists providing immunizations in the community. And 20 years ago, that was a brand new service. So pharmacists that began to offer immunizations had to go back and receive, at the time it was about an 18-hour continuing education course on everything related to immunology and the vaccines themselves and how to actually administer the injectable vaccine. Today, every student that graduates from a college of pharmacy across the country receives immunization training as part of their curriculum. So I don't know how many hours might be required in that continuing education. That would be up to the Department of Public Health and I believe the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine, the way the legislation is proposed.
Okay, and I understand in one of the subcommittees at least, the Iowa Pharmacy Association suggested adding a fee for pharmacists to provide this service because it would take up a bit more of their time. Representative Lundgren, is that something that you are supportive of adding to the legislation?
I would have to look at a proposal before I would say that I agree or disagree with it. I think the Senate has passed something or is looking at something as an amendment, and we would certainly consider that. But, until you actually see the verbiage in front of you, it's hard to say that you could be 100% supportive of it. We'll have to see what it says.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about a proposal being crafted that would expand access to birth control in Iowa. If you have a view or a concern, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Representatives Shannon Lundgren and Beth Wessel Crochelle with us. Also, Kate Gaynor of the Iowa Pharmacy Association, our guests. Kate Gaynor, you compared this to, pharmacists being able to give immunizations to the flu or whatever. But here, this is more of has many more facets. Would you not agree that we have a variety of ways to prevent conception here? And I wonder if among pharmacists there's with this new way of giving out contraception, would there be contraception methods that would be more challenging for pharmacists than others, more involved, require more supervision, more care?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It is complex. Hormones are complex when taken by women, kind of as Representative Lundgren alluded to. After a month or two, there should be a check-in to see, are there side effects? Are they able to adhere if it's taken at the same time every day based on the hormones that are included? That window of time it must be taken every 24 hours might be narrower than with a different drug. In other states, pharmacists under similar proposals also administer long-acting reversible contraceptives, so something that's injected similarly to how a immunization is injected via a syringe. That's not part of this proposal, but certainly that patient assessment piece is so important to understand what the woman's looking for, her ability to take a pill every day or apply the patch or insert a ring vaginally, the education that comes along with that. A patient's health history is so important, and that's part of an immunization screening too that happens, but there's probably fewer questions with an immunization than there would be with a hormonal contraceptive. So smoking status, a patient's weight, her ability to take a pill every day if it's that oral contraceptive, but also, unwanted side effects that you want to avoid, or sometimes with hormonal contraceptives, there are side effects that are desired. So are you trying to prevent acne and things like that? So definitely assessing that health history is an important piece, and don't want to minimize that at all. From other states that have passed similar legislation, and I believe currently 7 states allow pharmacists to provide hormonal contraceptive either through a statewide standing order or with direct prescriptive authority. And 7 additional states have proposals underway right now. We know from our colleagues in other states that it is typically a 20 to 30 minute encounter that pharmacists have with that patient in their pharmacy via a screening form and then sitting down and talking through, the same way a woman would if she visited her physician or in a clinic or a woman's health clinic. You want to be very thorough in selecting the right hormonal contraceptive. And that's why the Pharmacy Association and the members of the Senate subcommittee last week discussed ensuring there is a professional fee for that pharmacist time when they spend that with a patient. We've talked to our members who are supportive of providing this service, but also recognize it does take that professional's time in order to do that. The dispensing a birth control pill, just to share with the listeners, a 1 month supply, the pharmacy typically might make less than $5 on average, and that doesn't cover the time that a pharmacist would spend with a woman to identify the right therapy and really ensure that the intended outcomes are going to be achieved.
And Representative Wessel Crichel, I know one thing that you've mentioned a lot, even when the governor was first proposing this, is that insurance coverage of this service and getting birth control in this method is important. Can you talk a little bit about that? And are you happy with the way the bill is currently?
I think it's better than I thought it would be, and I really appreciate that. For, you know, a woman who doesn't have, let's say it can cost from $15 to $100 a month, from what I understand. And for a woman who doesn't have $15, she doesn't have $15. So it's really important that it gets covered by insurance, because if you don't have $15 for this, you certainly are not ready to have an unintended pregnancy. So I think the insurance coverage is critical.
We have an email from Brenda. Perhaps you just answered it, but maybe more focused on Brenda's email. She writes, will the new bill allow birth control pills without a prescription, meaning they will no longer be free? My cynical little brain was looking for another less altruistic reason, writes Brenda. I don't know if we can interpret that email. Do you have a response?
I think we have to acknowledge that it's never free. That we are, for those of us who have insurance, that is a benefit for, in my case, a benefit of employment. That is not free. And that is what covers prescriptions in my family. So prescriptions are always covered unless you do not have insurance. And that is always my concern. So I want to be very clear, though, that it's not free. It's a benefit of your health insurance.
And I would also like just to mention that it is not over the counter. I mean, this is a standing order from our Iowa medical director. This is a prescription. So it really isn't treated any differently than any RX that you would pick up at your pharmacist's office.
Representative Lundgren, I have a bit of a political question for you about this. Last year, you played a key role in getting the fetal heartbeat abortion law through the legislature. You spoke at an anti-abortion rally at the State House recently. Some of these groups, though, are not happy about this. What are you saying to those groups that are maybe not happy that you're ushering this through right now?
Well, you know, I think we owe it to our governor to take a look at legislation that she passes to our committees. And I'm certainly not the end-all be-all when it comes to who gets to decide what we pass through committee. Representative Wessel Crichel and I worked together on some of these things as ranking member of House Human Resource Committee. You know, the bottom line is we want to prevent pregnancy from happening. When we prevent pregnancy, we prevent abortion. And so it's certainly a different angle than we've taken over the last 2 years. But I am appreciative that the governor wants us talking about it and making sure that we are finding other ways to prevent unintended pregnancies.
Let's finish up our conversation by going to a caller, listener Tim in Ames. Welcome to the program. Tim, we're short on time. We're sure glad you called, though.
Yeah, so I had a question. When the pharmacist becomes the primary provider of these medications and managing them, are they equipped to handle the liability costs that potentially lawsuits from adverse reactions, et cetera, as a physician has to take liability insurance out? Are pharmacists equipped with that same protection in these instances?
Kate Gaynor, perhaps you can comment on that.
Sure. Thank you, Tim, for the question. And it's not the first time we've received that question. Actually, legislators have asked that along with other stakeholders. And pharmacists also have professional liability insurance. It's similar in terms of their coverage. Anything that's part of the pharmacist's scope of practice within their state is covered under the liability insurance. In fact, a good Iowa plug, based in Algona, Iowa, is a national pharmacy insurance company called Pharmacist Mutual that provides that liability insurance for many of Iowa's pharmacists as well as pharmacists across the country. And as pharmacists' role continues to expand, the claims that Pharmacist Mutual, and from my conversation with them, really has shifted. So they are more related not just to dispensing errors, but pharmacists' acknowledgement of their role as that patient's healthcare provider. So yes, that would be part of the service. They're equipped and have liability coverage as well.
And I'd also like to add that, the bill actually has protection for civil and criminal liabilities if the pharmacist is following the intent of the law. So if the law is written and they're following and doing what they're supposed to do, it does have that protection for them on that side. So the liability insurance is important if they're not following the law. But in general, we don't think that that's going to be a concern or an issue.
We have just a few seconds left. Representative Beth Wessel-Crochelle and Representative Shannon Lundgren, a quick forecast from each of your parties. Beth Wessel-Crochelle, the Democrats are all for this, mostly?
I have to tell you, I have not asked my caucus, but I have been working with them on these issues for many, many years, and I have to believe that they will be supportive.
Shannon Lundgren, what's your forecast for the Republicans?
Well, we certainly have been having the conversation as well, and I've asked them to give me their feedback, and I haven't heard from everybody yet in my caucus, so I'm not going to speak for them, but I have every intention and belief that we'll pass it out of committee this week and then let leadership decide where it goes from there.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Shannon Lundgren, Representative Beth Wessel-Crochelle, and Kate Gaynor of the Iowa Pharmacy Association. Thank you so much. And on behalf of Katarina Sestarek, my co-host for these Legislative Mondays, our IPR state government reporter, we'll look forward to next Monday's reporting from the State House. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.